First of all, I would like to start by thanking KITP for hosting this program. I'm having a lot of fun, and to the organizers for setting it up. As Kumru mentioned, I'm a social organizer, so if you have any social activities you'd like to propose, just let me know anytime. I'm always happy to help with that. Okay, so yeah, as those of you who know me know that one of my favorite pastimes is doing nothing. So I really think I have something to say about that. And this is going to be a talk about why I think that nothing really matters, something important. So this is, I'm going to be talking about some ongoing work, which I think is so far is the longest project I've been involved with. We started already 2 years ago. We're finishing the draft now, so it's going to be out pretty soon. With Iñaki García Echevarría, Kepa Sosa, and Irene. And I feel that I'm not going to be talking about a paper that came out earlier this month by the Death of Adrian Silo. Also about nothing with the same. Okay. So basically, since we started the project, we had this title in mind. I already gave a talk with this title, but now the title got. They got it. You know, it's on archive. It's theirs. So we need to find something else. So before the talk starts, I just want to say that I'm open for suggestions. If at some point you guys, have an interesting suggestion for the title, just let me know after the talk, and we might take it into consideration. So for the time being, and in order to be able to really distinguish the two things, I'm just gonna add some qualification. But I hope we can do better than that. Thanks. It's just a late night. Okay. So yeah. So this is gonna be a talk about bubbles of nothing. Okay. Bubble of nothing instead of it. So I'm gonna start by reviewing Witten's bubble of nothing. Okay. Perhaps it would be better to start with a few words. Why are we interested in this kind of bubbles of nothing? Right. Like the broad question that we want to answer is. What kind of instabilities can supersymmetric or non-supersymmetric vacua have in consistent quantum theories of gravity? And it's often the case, and when we embed a solution in string theory, there's particularly when it's non-supersymmetric, we can always find some sort of instability, which depends on the model. Like sometimes, there's this particular combination of brains that the flux can unwind, and so on and so forth. But there is also, these are instabilities which are typically always there, but they're also very model dependent. The way this happens in one model or another is pretty different. And it would be nice to see if there's some sort of universal instability that one can understand from the point of view of low energy effective theory. But this is an instability of some quantum gravity vacuum. And the paradigmatic example of that is Witten's bubble of nothing. Okay, so the setup for Witten's bubble of nothing is the following. Just consider some Einstein's theory of gravity on five dimensions, so 5D gravity, plus possibly some matter. And we're going to be looking at what happens when you compactify this theory to R4 times S1. Okay, so we're going to be looking at the Kaluza-Klein vacuum. What is the dynamics of this thing? Well, this will start you dimensional reduction, you get the gravity photon, you get a radion, and typically the radion gets a potential. And depending on the matter content of the theory, it might be that this potential has a runaway direction, or it might be that you can stabilize it for particular kinds of matter content, or for instance, one particular way in which you can stabilize this thing is if you have an axiom, and then you just put any units of flux on the circle, then you can actually play around the two things to stabilize it. So if you manage to do this, you have a nice four-dimensional vacuum. It's a perturbatively stable vacuum. And from the point of view of the Lorentz effective theory, it seems nice. It's just some Kaluza-Klein vacuum. However, Witten told us that something funny happens if we look at this particular metric. where this guy is parameterizing the compact circle, and these are coordinates in on the transfer space. Okay, so what is this metric? This metric is just a particular analytic continuation of the 5D Schwarzschild black hole. So when you take the 5D Schwarzschild black hole, typically there's the thermal circle that is the one you continue back to get the useful Schwarzschild solution in 5 dimensions. But you might also continue analytically along one of the angular coordinates in the angular sphere. And if you do, you get this solution. What I wrote you guys actually was the Schwarzschild solution. I wanted to have the analytic continuation, so it was this thing. Okay, so I basically took one of the two of the angles of the free sphere, and I continued analytically to Minkowski, and that's why it gets a time-like sign. Okay, so this metric is going to be a solution of the vacuum Einstein equations, let's look at what these properties are. So first of all, the one thing that you can see is that it has a coordinate singularity at r equals to r. Now, this is a story in general relativity. You gotta figure out if this is just a coordinate singularity and you can continue the space-time, or if space-time is actually ending there. And kind of like, for instance, at the origin in polar coordinates. And in this particular case, it's kind of like the origin in polar coordinates, so space-time is ending. Okay, at this value of the coordinate. What is the asymptotics of the metric? For r much bigger than r, this metric looks like this. So the KK circle is doing its own thing, it's not changing size. And this four-dimensional metric, you might recognize. Does anybody recognize that metric? It's actually Minkowski space in Rinder coordinates. So if I make the change of variables x equal to r cos psi and p r psi, then the metric is just this thing. Just the Minkowski metric. Okay, so this is a metric, the metric that we just constructed, far away from the core when the radius is large, looks like Minkowski, looks like the Minkowski vacuum, right? But because of this restriction, we do not get the full Minkowski solution, but just a patch of it. Okay, so if this is the xt plane, so x is here the radial coordinate, this restriction with change of variables means that we just get a patch of Minkowski space, which is x squared minus t squared plus e equal to r squared. Okay, so we get something like this. This is an hyperboloid. I want to draw it. Get something like this, and this part of space-time has been removed. Okay, so what is this describing? This is a geometry where, from the point of view of the four-dimensional observer, there is far away just looks like Minkowski space, nothing is happening. But as you get close to here, space-time all of a sudden ends. And, it's not just that. This is the time coordinate. So t equals 0, space-time ends. But if you look at times bigger than 0, the region where space-time ends is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay? So it looks like an instability of the vacuum. It looks like a Coleman-Deluccia, bubble nucleation process, with one crucial difference. In the Coleman-Deluccia picture, you can just go to the true vacuum instead of the bubble. But here, this region is absent from the ambient spacetime. How do you see that it's absent? Well, to see that, it's pretty useful to look at what the Kaluza-Klein circle does, as we get here. So out here, it has some finite size. And if you just look at this metric component, the KK circle goes to zero size as you get to the, you know, as you get to the to the boundary level. So if, for instance, I draw the Kalosa kind of circle over this line, it's doing something like this. Okay, so it's kind of like pinching off in this particular way. Space-time is ending. Well, this is what the bubble of nothing is. Okay, it's a bubble and it really has nothing inside of what people call a bubble of nothing. So we constructed this solution, but importantly, one important property of this solution, which I didn't write yet, is that it has zero ADM mass. If you look at the solution at t equals zero, and you just compute its ADM mass, it happens to be zero.
So it's crucial that your boundary condition, you don't have any Fermi at zero.
I'm gonna throw the Fermi's in the picture in a moment. Yes.
What about the axion that you were talking about?
Yes.
You also introduced an axion at some point.
That's very good. So I was not being specific. I was just like listing ways in which you could, you're right. Yeah. So I was introducing ways in which you could stabilize this potential. You can do it with Casimir energies. You can also introduce actions. If you introduce actions, that also leads to an obstruction to the bubble, kind of like the spin structure. Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, were you saying that one for flux on the circle stabilizes the circle?
One for flux plus Casimir energies. Yeah. I just wanted to. So the point is that if I want to stabilize it just with Casimir energies, I need to put certain boundary conditions for the fermions, and I wanted to kind of have be free for that. But anyway, so by the way, most of this talk I'm going to be concerning about these non-perturbative instabilities. I'm going to be cavalier about perturbative instabilities, which is maybe not the right thing to do. I mean, the perturbative instabilities are often more important. The philosophy behind working about bubbles of nothing in this way is that even if somehow you're able to start to get rid of the perturbative instabilities, these guys are still there.
But you don't expect that, right? I guess that's always been the question. Why do people talk about non-perturbative one where we know there are going to be?
That's right. So I don't have any example where I'm rid of all perturbative instabilities. I'm just saying that even if there was some, then these guys are still there.
But say, larger than curvature, it's in units of Planck mass, right? So when Planck mass goes to infinity, let's say that we're going to the limit of weak gravity, then right-hand side goes to zero, right? So it means that your region goes to zero, and that's, in this sense, I can try to do just normal perturbation theory.
Wait. So here's the thing. The solution exists for any finite value of M Planck.
But the size of this region would go to zero.
But crucially, this region is growing. I agree that the critical size at which it's nucleated can be very small, but the region is always growing. You can always write this solution as long as you can try it, and you can trust Einstein gravity.
But the width will be still go at any slice will be still goes to zero.
Arkady, the initial size of the bubble is fixed by the size of your circle at infinity.
Right.
You compactify on some scale at infinity, and that fixes the size of a circle.
But let's say that I'm considering the limit where mass of Planck goes to infinity.
It's a classical solution. It doesn't care about M Planck. Uh-huh. It's a radius there. It's not a mass.
I see. Okay.
There's one thing that does care about sending M Planck to infinity, which is related to this thing. So what I was going to say here about the mass being zero, that means that it's energetically possible for the vacuum to decay to this guy. You can actually compute the tunneling rate in the Euclidean formalism, right? And it's pretty nice. It's tunneling rate goes like, into the for 4G. So it's kind of like the black hole. So this tunneling rate really, you know, goes away in the fast speed thing. But the solution is always there. Okay. Okay. So this is the bubble of nothing. This is a nice instability. But it's not very popular. It's not like a mainstream thing. You talk to people, and many people don't know what a bubble of nothing is. And I think there's basically two reasons for that, which I'm just gonna list here. Well, first of all, this bubble exists for, you know, a certain compactification, or more generally for very specific geometries. Like, people have constructed these things for the circle compactifications and perhaps things with spheres a little bit more. And the second, which is what Kuhnrund was mentioning, there can be topological obstructions to the existence of the body. Okay? And the paradigmatic example of this was given in Witten's original paper. Because he said, suppose that the theory that we're talking about contains fermions. Okay? If it has fermions, we need to specify boundary conditions for the fermions along the Kaluza-Klein circle. Okay? So you need to specify the fermions are periodic or antiperiodic. And this bubble solution only exists for antiperiodic boundary conditions for the fermions. And there's actually a very simple way of seeing why this is the case. So look at this picture. There's a Kaluza-Klein circle. And in the bubble spacetime, it's actually the boundary of this cigar. So you can just plot it as a disk. You just say that the Kaluza-Klein circle is the boundary of the disk. Now, if you're trying to define spinners in some simply connected domain, in something like a disk, one of the first things that you learn is that when you rotate the spinner 360 degrees, it picks up a minus one, right? So that means that you get a spinner here, and you rotate 360 degrees on a disk, it must get the antiperiodic boundary conditions. So this thing does not exist for periodic boundary conditions. It doesn't exist for periodic boundary conditions. So that's another reason why people were not worrying too much about them. Because, you know, I could always just choose periodic boundary conditions, which are the nice boundary conditions for supersymmetry preservation anyway. And, you know, then I could just perhaps break supersymmetry spontaneously. As long as I don't change the boundary conditions of the fermions, this bubble is not going to be there. Okay? So this is just like the basic law of bubbles of nothing that I think should be important for this. Any questions so far? No questions?
But if the supersymmetry would be pleasant, then you would be looking for a periodic boundary condition, probably.
That's right. That's what people do. They say, forget about this thing. I'm just going to set periodic boundary conditions, and the thing is gone, right?
Right.
Okay, so the main point of my talk is that these two things are false in general. In general, I'm going to be constructing bubbles of nothing for more general spacetimes. And in particular, I'm going to be focusing mostly on the second point. This topological obstruction is absent the moment that you start looking at higher dimensions. Okay? So bubbles of nothing, you can construct them for much more general compatible cases than one would have thought originally.
But the obstruction for topological reasons should not be there for any quantum gravity.
That's right. I'm going to be talking about that
more
as well.
More general than in particular.
Yes. I'm going to be talking about that as well. The point that we're making is that sometimes, so the point that you're making with the Bortician groups in quantum gravity is a UV point. Sometimes to construct the bubble of nothing using quantum gravity, you need to introduce brains and objects like that.
No, one is to write a concrete example. The other one is to know if there is a bubble of nothing. The statement is that even with a circle, with an
the periodic boundary condition,
which you would have thought there is no way, there should be a way to get.
That's right, because you could imagine there's some UV object in the theory, some sort of spin defect that you can put here that changes the boundary conditions of the
spin.
And
more than that, you should have it. In other words.
That's right. But introducing this object introduces some sort of UV sensitivity in the picture. I don't know what the tension of this object is from the point of view of low energy effective
filter. It's not easy, but that the existence.
Right. So what I'm saying is that even if one restricts, if you restrict yourself to stuff that can be, to bubbles that can be completely described within supergravity, bubbles that do not involve these UV objects in any way, even in that case, it's pretty often the case that the relevant Bortician groups vanish, and you can have more bubbles then.
When you talk about the UV, I mean, knowing that there is a circle is something that is in the UV.
But there's like a hierarchy here, right? There's the UV, and then there's like this brain-like object, which is really, you know, like it's like KK scale versus scale of the tension of the brain, something like this.
So it's not full IR.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is that the KK solution here, Witten solution, I can describe using gravity, using effective field theory, this other thing I could. Okay?
5D gravity.
Yeah, 5D gravity, that's right. Okay, so. So that's the claim, and now I'm going to tell you how to construct bubbles, more generally. And Kuhnmann already hinted that it's related to Bortician groups. But I'm going to explain that. I'm going to explain how these bubbles are related to borders and groups. Okay? So, what did we do here exactly? How did we construct the bubble? Well, we started with some vacuum, which had this topology. And we found some configuration which has sort of the metric glues well asymptotically, but which had a different topology. You have to imagine that on top of this plot, there's always an S2 fiber over all the place. You know, there's an S2 that never goes to zero size. So the topology of the solution is actually something like S2 times a disk. Now, because this cigar is kind of like a disk. So suppose that now we want to construct a bubble of nothing for your favorite Calabria compactification. So there's some Calabria manifold times flat space, right? And you want to construct a bubble like this? Well, then you should be looking for solutions that do something like this. Well, instead of having the circle here, you got the Calabria, or whatever compactification space you have. And that somehow this is your compactification space is some compactification space X with D dimensions. Instead of the disk, you have some D plus one dimension manifold, like D plus one, such that the picture holds. So you're actually, if you're looking at the theory in D dimensions, and you're looking for a bubble of nothing for a compactification of xd times r d capital D minus little d, then the bubble is going to have, topologically, it's going to look like this. Okay? Where the basic relation between y and x is that the boundary, topologically, the boundary of y, is x. Okay? How do we construct a bubble of nothing? At least just topologically, I'm just constructing the topology. There's going to be two steps to all this theory. First, you need to find the right topology for the bubble. Then you need to solve Einstein's equations. Okay? I'm just doing step one right now. So how do you do this? You need to find something like this. For which xds can you find something like this? It's a question that mathematicians have pondered and kind of answered. And the answer takes the name of borders and groups. So what is borderism? Borderism is an equivalent relation between manifolds. You get some manifold x1 and some other manifold x2, which is different, topology can be different or whatever. You can say that x1 is equivalent to x2 if both x1 and x2 with opposite orientations are the boundary of some manifold y, one dimension more. Okay? So this defines an equivalence relation between manifolds. But this equivalence relation is actually, you can give it a group structure. Okay? So basically, the sum rule, so the same, is that the equivalence class of x1 plus x2 is the equivalence class of the connected sum. Where connected sum just means that you get some manifold x and some manifold x1 and x2, you basically delete a small neighborhood and glue them with a tube in an appropriate way. That's the connected sum, okay? So these things are groups. The important point is that these groups have been computed by mathematicians, so we don't reveal the word for us. And we're only gonna have bubbles for the trivial class. The things that are coordinate to a point. Okay, so I'm gonna be calling those guys null vertices. Okay. There is any questions so far? Yeah.
Yeah. So, from the point of view of the higher dimensional space, this is just a homology group, right?
No. This is not homology. This is not just homology, right? These things can there can be cycles here. They can shrink here and there. Yeah. It's not just homology. It's a more coarse description. So you can have things with completely different homologies which are covariant. Okay. So this is the Bordeaux McIlwain's relation, and you can actually make it stronger if you add. Sometimes you know your theory actually contains extra data that you're interested in. So for instance, you know, you were just discussing an example where we have spinners. So you want to have a spin structure here. Or sometimes you might have fluxes, like axiom fluxes, and you also want that to exist. So whenever these things are included, you need to extend all these fluxes to this manifold. So that defines like different notions of Bordeaux groups. There's spin Bordeaux, omega spin D. That's how you denote the Bordeaux groups. This is just the set of equivalence classes of manifolds under this equivalence relation, such that you have a spin structure that carries over to this guy. And you can also, there are different variants where you have, for instance, spin structure, and you also have fluxes of different kinds. And I might be describing that later on. So there's a bunch of Bordeaux groups. Mathematicians have computed some of them, and they have tools to compute the others. So what is the one that is relevant for quantum gravity? So as Kuhnrund was saying, he recently had a conjecture, which is basically just a restatement of the idea there should be no global symmetry in quantum gravity, which is that the Bordeaux groups in quantum gravity, the ones that really matter in the DPUB in any quantum theory of gravity, should vanish. Okay? So that means that for any compactification space, you should be able to get a bubble of nothing. And as we were mentioning before, that means, for instance, that also the circle with periodic boundary conditions, you should be able to get a bubble of nothing in the full quantum gravity theory. So we were having the disk, and if we want to have periodic boundary conditions here, you need to put some kind of defect, some UV brain, such that they will fix the boundary conditions for the spinners. Another example of this, Pablo was mentioning why we have fluxes, there's an obstruction. Yes, there's an obstruction. If you have some kind of Ramon-Ramon flux threading the circle, then you know it cannot enter unless I put the right kind of brain. So in string theory, I always have this kind of bubble. Yes?
If you're saying there's always a bubble of nothing, then doesn't that mean there's no stable vacuum?
Yes, that I guess that would be, okay, well,
no,
depends, except, so there's 2 points. Topologically, yes. Topologically, there's always a bubble of nothing. But you also need to solve Einstein's equations. And there's going to be also dynamical obstruction for that. So supersymmetric vacuum are stable. But what I'm saying is that there's no topological obstruction to the existence of bubbles of nothing.
Okay, just topological.
Just topological. Then I'm going to spend quite some time talking about
right.
The dynamical part. So this is the thing that should be true in the DPUB. But as I said, in this talk, I'm interested in bubbles that you can construct from, you know, just from the IR, from effective field theory. So I basically just don't want to be thinking about configurations where you have a defect like this. Because I don't know, as I mentioned before, I don't know how to compute their action. I don't know how to solve Einstein's equations. I need to put a boundary conditions. I want to go for the easy thing. So this is a UV statement, but in the IR, so to say, there can be some other Bordeaux group, which is the obstruction that you get to constructing these bubbles purely in the lower effective field theory. And this thing might very well be non-zero. Okay?
Sorry.
Yes?
On a more intuitive level, does it mean that I don't have enough energy to create the defect that I need? Is that what it means, that the amount of energy would be beyond the effective field theory?
Well, so all of these bubbles of nothing, because they're instabilities of the vacuum, they have zero mass. So you always are trying to compensate, you know, some negative energy that goes in one way from the other. Whenever, what this means is that if you want to construct a bubble, in some cases, you will need to introduce UV objects that are not part of the effective field theory. There's objects, of course, that typically have high tensions. So then this is the question of how are you going to solve Einstein's equation in that manifold. Okay. So, yeah. So that's the. Okay. So.
Sorry,
yes.
The the bubbles of critical size have zero mass, but you can, but if you want to create smaller ones, it might well be true that these are extremely massive.
That is true, and also the bigger ones will have negative mass. Yeah. Sort of. Yeah, that's right. This is why this is also an instability, sort of, in a very natural way. Because the critical one has zero mass, but you could imagine make a bigger one and it has negative mass. Anyway, so this is like the abstract discussion, and let's try to connect to Witten's example. How do we understand Witten's example in terms of borders and groups? Well, there we just have a one-dimensional compactification manifold. So whatever borders and group we're looking at is going to be an omega one. And what structure do we want to put on it? Well, there was this discussion about fermions, right? The discussion is interesting when we have fermions. So let's just say that we just want to have a spin structure. Having a spin structure is basically a choice of boundary conditions for fermions. So you just need to look at this thing. Okay, so then we look at a mathematics book. And then mathematicians tells us that the first dimensional spin Bordesian group is Z2. And they also tell us what the generator is. So the generator is the S1 with periodic boundary conditions. Okay? So it fits exactly with what we were saying with Witten's bubble before. The S1 with periodic boundary conditions is non-trivial in Bordesian, therefore we cannot construct a bubble of nothing. The circle with antiperiodic boundary conditions is trivial in Bordesian, and thus we can't construct a bubble of nothing. Okay? So that's good. So finally we recovered everything that we had before in this different language, and now the thing is going to start paying off, because now we can go away from talking about the bubble constantly. So let's just keep in spin Bordesian, okay? For the time being, let's just forget all fluxes and whatever, just look at the Bordesian with fermions, you know, theories with fermions. So what is the second two-dimensional spin Bordesian group? It's Z2. And again, it's Z2. And the generator is T2 with periodic boundary conditions. So this is not surprising, right? We have a circle, then we have two circles, and if we don't want to be able to glue one of Witten's bubbles in one of the two sides, it must be that the two circles have the periodic spin structure, right? Otherwise, I could just, you know, you take the torus, and if this cycle has a periodic boundary condition, then you just glue Witten's bubble of Macron there, and that's not what it is. Okay? So it's Z2. So you see the pattern with circles, right? It's omega 1, Z2. Omega 2 is spin 2, is Z2. So can anyone guess what is omega 3 spin?
Z5.
That's right. Okay. Okay, so we have one bet. One bet is Z5. We have any other bets? Come on. I'm trying to. Of course, Abdul.
Obviously, I'm trying to serial.
That's right. That's here. Yeah. Okay. I wanted someone to say Z2, you know, because. But that's right. The third dimensional spin producing group is zero. And when we first learned about this, this was a mind blow, because this is telling you that any three manifold whatsoever with any spin structure is the boundary of someone else. So there's not a polygonal obstruction for these guys. There's just not a polygonal obstruction for the system of bubbles of nothing. In particular, if you take a T3 with periodic boundary conditions on the three cycles, so the T3 with the supersymmetry preserving boundary conditions, this thing is going to be the boundary. It's going to be the boundary of some four manifold, which I'm going to call B, because I'm going to be writing about it a lot. Okay? So, one thing that we did is we analyzed this scale. We beat this problem today. We analyzed it in detail. I'm going to tell you what the Bordesian is, what this weird guy is, topologically first, and then we're going to move on to try and solve Einstein's equations.
So, this is a well-known B, though.
Okay. That's exactly right. It was just not well known to us, I guess.
But it's part of the F3
group 1. Right. Yeah, indeed. Yeah,
the construction was.
Yes. It's just,
So the solving is done already.
Topology
3.
I mean, he has to get there, but the whole point of the project is the dynamics of the bubbles.
That's right.
Like, to understand how in the supersymmetric case is forbidden, and whether we can say that as in, every time you break supersymmetry will be allowed or not. How you break supersymmetry.
So that's right. So the point is that we are going to be trying to solve Einstein's equations here. And then there's going to be two cases. When you just solve Einstein's equations in something which is a consistent truncation of a supersymmetric theory, we should not find a solution. Because if we were to find a solution, that would be an instability for a supersymmetric vacuum, which cannot happen. So we're going to first be doing that, and then I'm going to show you how you can evade this in a non-supersymmetric vacuum, in a non-supersymmetric construction, in an interesting way, such that you do get a bubble. Okay? So finite action solution of Einstein's equations for this tuple. Okay? So indeed, as Kuhnrum said, such that its boundary is T3 with all periodic boundary conditions, is actually just DP9 with a hole. Okay, so you start with DP9, which is just going to be writing as a vibration over the P231 vibration over P1. Okay, where this thing has degree 4, and this thing has degree 6. Okay, so then you have also like U1, U2, U3, U4. Okay, so if you take this manifold, this is a torus vibration, this is a torus fiber over a sphere, basically. P1 is just a sphere, right? So you get a T2 fiber over a sphere. This is a compact manifold. If in this manifold, you just take a tiny disk on the base around the generic point of the where the fiber is not degenerating, and you just remove this thing together where it's pulled back in the total space, then this is clearly a manifold whose boundary is a T3, because if you just zoom in this region, you get a circle there, which we are removing, and in the total space, there's also T2. Which is floating around. You're not floating around on top of the space. So basically the topology of the boundary of the space that I just constructed is T2 versus 1, which is T3. And you can actually prove via an argument using index theorem that this thing has exactly the periodic boundary conditions on the circle. Okay, so that is the topology of the solution. Now we need to try and solve Einstein's equations there, right? Which is going to be a challenge. This is a complicated. So when you look at it on the other side, so you just look at and how the space looks away from this disk. You can just write it as a elliptic vibration, as a torus vibration over a disk where the fiber pinches at 12 different points. So it's a complicated space where there's a torus which is pinching in, you know, different 12 different ways. So you got to solve Einstein's equations there. And first I'm going to explain why we cannot just solve Einstein's equations. We're going to solve Einstein's equations, R mu mu, mu mu, right? And we want to do it with a particular asymptotic, particular metric. So the metric that we're going to be using, remember, the Bohrism is always topologically a product like this. So we're just going to have a warped sphere over the base of the vortism.
Does the same game work for any elliptic fiber surface, say K3?
Yes. What do you mean exactly?
I mean, you're cutting out this one, and then
the point is that you need to show that the spin structure on the T3 restricts like this. So for any elliptic vibration, you can do it like that. You know, we just take a two-real vibration, then it's a disk times T2. But we agree that the disk has an antiperiodic spin structure. So only for this case, you get the fully periodic spin structure. So this is okay, so we want a metric on this guy. And we're just going to take a metric before we answer, which is just some work factor. So I'm going to take some coordinates y here. So there's going to be some warping factor, y, and then, you know, the round symmetric for the sphere, plus some metric. On the vortices, okay? So this is the metric that we are trying to plug into Einstein's equations, but we also need to specify what are the asymptotics, okay? Remember, Witten's bubble of nothing glues well with the asymptotic Kaluza-Klein vacuum. So we need to ask that the same happens here. So I'm just gonna deform this picture to squeeze the vortices to say that there's something like, you know, just drawing it in a different way. But there's some C3 close to the boundary, and then there's this thing where, you know, it's got holes and whatever. So what should happen is that there's some sort of, out of these y coordinates, there's some combination which is some sort of radial coordinate, such that when r is, you know, going to infinity, this guy goes to R, and this metric on the board is on dy a dy b, goes to something like dr squared plus the metric on the flat q torus, okay? Such that, you know, the total metric is just, well, it becomes what we want. Okay? So just basically this regular coordinate in the board is on combines with the angular coordinate here. Okay?
So, excuse me, what you've written down is just a spatial metric at one moment of time.
Oh, sorry. I was sorry. No, at some point I switched to solving the Euclidean equations of motion. So I'm solving Einstein's equations in the Euclidean. So the bubble of nothing that we were discussing here, you're right, sorry. The bubble of nothing we were discussing here was a Lorentzian metric. Okay? But we got it by analytic continuation of the time of the one of the angular coordinates of the Euclidean Schwarzschild metric.
So I'm just thinking it's a lot easier if you, you know, to find the solution, all you have to do is solve the constraint.
That's right. That's everything about
the bubble, you know, can be formulated in terms of initial data.
That's right.
So you just take one moment of time. You don't need to solve the full Einstein.
That's right. We thought about that as well. In the end, it's going to be the same because the obstruction that we get to constructing this bubble comes from Witten's positive energy theorem. From the positive mass theorem. It's about surfaces at constant time. So in the end, it's just solving the constraints.
But isn't this just the usual string, cosmic string? What are we...
That's right. We are going to be using that metric too.
So is that different?
No. So the problem. So the, of course, there's a Ricci flat metric on this manifold, which is the one you constructed.
Well, we didn't construct it. We just borrowed the technology from existence of it. To actually explicitly construct it, nobody has been able to do it.
Right.
But we can do it in singular limits explicitly. Like T4 mod Z2 is an example. Take T4 mod Z2 and cut it in half, that's an example. So
right.
If you're okay with singularities, you're fine.
So
explicit metric, nobody has today been able to write.
Right. So part of what we've been doing, we've been making this patchwise construction where we define the metric patchwise and we try to glue it together, and it's an exponentially good approximation to this metric. It's not exactly.
Yeah. So that's the kind of thing we'd be studying in that paper.
Yeah.
You're trying to write an approximate metric. Is that what you're?
So talking? I'm saying that the metric you have in that paper also becomes singular at the generations of the fiber, right? So we also needed a metric which was within the total space. So we can also regularize with geophysics with tau nuts. Just glue the tau nut metric there. It's not that. But what I was going to say is that metric is Ricci flat.
Yeah.
And by virtue of being Ricci flat, it is not possible to find the right warp factor for solving Einstein's equations with these asymptotics.
Ricci flat is not solving Einstein's equations to me.
No. Ricci flat is solving. We need to find a metric on the product, not just the Bordeson. It's the Bordeson times the sphere. Exactly.
So you say that half K3 for you, which is the Ricci flat, and all that is not a solution to Einstein's equation?
No, that is a solution of Einstein's equation in four dimensions, but we're trying to find. So the point is that we also have some non compact dimensions, right? So we're trying to compactify on T3 times R D minus 3. Okay? And when you go into the Bordeson, the radial direction of this R3 becomes part of the Bordeson, and there's the S. D minus 4. That also goes along for the right. So we're trying to find a solution of Einstein's equations on B times S D minus 4. The whole thing. Okay?
SD minus, what is SD minus 4?
SD minus 4 is a sphere in D minus 4 dimensions.
D is the space, the microscopic space-time?
Yeah, it's a microscopic space-time.
Why do you need that? You can just take one of the directions of the space-time and just do it. Just take a domain wall.
But then it's going to be a flat, that's right, that would work. But then it's going to be a flat domain wall. It's not going to have the flat space in it. It's going to be like a bubble where the critical radius.
You want to find the bubble?
So the bubble you're describing has infinite critical radius.
Yes.
So
you're going to find a finite radius.
It's not going exactly. We're going to want a finite radius.
So you're going to look for five dimensionalities or say more dimensions.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I should have said that. So I'm looking now in the same way that with Witten's bubble of nothing, we're looking at compactification of five dimensions on a circle. We're going to be looking now our compactification to our d minus 3 times d3, and then we're going to try and construct a bubble using this factor. Okay. And we're going to bubble of finite action, so the flat bubble that you construct with the semi-flat metric wouldn't work for us. Okay.
So for d equals to, for one of them it would work. If the dimension was one dimensional for you, that would be exactly what you want. You want more dimensions.
That's right. But in the one dimensional case, it would work. That's true. Yes, because there's nothing here.
How much does this depend on having flat space, Mingus? Because you're saying that supersymmetry prevents this from happening. But if you don't have supersymmetry, you probably won't have flat Minkowski.
Right. So not too much. We just solve the equations in the flat case. I don't know what should happen. You would expect that, but these kind of bubbles are also there, for instance, in ADS and in the sitter. But we just didn't solve the equations in those cases. Okay.
Just
solving Einstein's equations. Let me just go actually describe why this equation with these asymptotics doesn't have a solution. In this part, whenever you have supersymmetry and more generally. So I was saying that there's a topological obstruction, which we got rid of. But there is also often a dynamical obstruction, which comes from Witten's positive, well, it's not Witten's, but you have a spin up with that. So from the positive energy theorem. Positive energy theorem tells us that in any theory of gravity in which two hypotheses, which I'm going to describe momentarily, hold, the only solution of zero mass is the vacuum, is the Perle vacuum, so this guy. If you want to have a bubble that nucleates and expands, as I was emphasizing before, this is a solution which also has zero mass, but it's different from the vacuum. So whenever this theorem holds, you're never going to be able to solve Einstein's equations. So what are the two hypotheses that you need to have for this thing? So you need asymptotically covariantly constant spinners. Okay, so you need to be able to define spinners in your space, which are covariantly constant, close to the boundary of the vortism, which is the same as saying that you should have covariantly constant spinners here. And there you see the connection with supersymmetry. Whenever you have compactification on a supersymmetry background, you at least have one covariantly constant spinner. So we're not going to get rid of this assumption. This is almost, just determined by the asymptotic metrics, so it's not going to change too much. The second condition you need to impose is the dominant energy condition. It's a local energy condition. So there's the asymptotic condition and a local condition. Which basically tells you that at any point, it basically is telling you that the flux, so if this is a time-like vector, then the flux of energy momentum tensor into any time-like direction should be a positive, causal future pointing vector. It's basically saying that locally, energy density can all flow faster than the speed of light. Okay? So, these two hypotheses hold whenever you have a supersymmetric compactification. So that's why you didn't get a bubble. And now, I'm going to tell you how to evade this theorem by getting rid of this second assumption. Okay? So we're going to be looking at theories that do not satisfy the dominant energy condition. Now, so just gonna. So now dominant boundary condition, we're gonna see leads to a bubble. How reasonable is it to just say that you violate the dominant energy condition? The way I presented it seems like this very natural condition that energy density should be the flux of energy should not be faster than the speed of light. Well, we know classically it's a reasonable hypothesis classically, but quantum mechanically, so it can be violated by quantum effects. So dominant energy condition is violated by quantum effects. It's also, for instance, violated by negative energy density. For instance, also violated just in ADS. Just this version of the energy condition that I just wrote is violated in ADS. It seems like a nice condition to have at the classical level, but not quantum mechanics. On the other hand, a random violation of the dominant energy condition is also not good, because it can lead to traversable wormholes, time machines, and things that we wouldn't like to have. So what we're going to be doing here is we're going to be violating the dominant energy condition by quantum effects, and in string theory, these are not so different from higher derivative terms.
Quick question.
Yes.
Why do you hate traversable wormholes?
Sure.
Why do you hate traversable wormholes?
Oh, well, sorry. Traversable wormholes, which are shorter than the distance from the outside, is a time machine. Sorry, I was not precise.
Why do you hate time machines? Yeah.
Look, I love time machines. You know, Alexander, I love these kinds of things, but I just... Let's put it like this. It's not too crazy to forbid these things for the time being.
That's okay.
If you have ideas in that regard, I would like to hear. Right. Anyway. So we're going to try to violate these things with higher derivative terms, okay? Which are also different from quantum effects in string theory. Often in string theory compactification, what looks like a classical higher derivative term in one frame, it's a quantum thing in the other. So I'm just going to write down the concrete Lagrangian of a model in which we can construct the bubble. So I'm going to describe how to construct the bubble. So we're just going to be looking at Einstein. We want it to be string-inspired, because later on we're going to actually be embedding this thing in string theory. This is another reason why the higher derivative terms that we are looking at are actually a good choice. So you get something like this. So I'm just going to have the metric, a dilaton, and crucially, this is the higher derivative term that's going to do the trick for us. A Gauss Bonnet term. Okay? So the Gauss Bonnet term, as probably most of you know, it's a higher term that you can add to your equations of motion. When you add a generic modification, a generic higher term, the equations of motion, they get ghosts and whatever, you get this Ostrogradsky instability. But for this particular guy, the equations of motion are still nice and second order. Furthermore, this term is topological in four dimensions, but not in higher dimensions. Okay. So, if you solve the equations of motion for this theory, you can, rewrite the extra curvature contribution coming from this guy to an effective stress energy tensor. So the effective stress energy tensor is the stress energy tensor of the dilaton, plus the stress energy tensor of this guy. And this term, in perturbation theory, when you evaluate it in the background, can violate the dominant energy condition. Okay? That's the setup. So the equations of motion of this theory with these asymptotics. So how are we going to be doing that? We're going to be doing it using perturbation theory.
Okay. Is that perturbation just come from breaking out some heavy stuff?
That's right. So for instance, in a string embeddings, this is just alpha prime. This is a string a string effect.
Understanding that alpha prime violates the dominant energy condition is crucially depends on the sign of alpha.
That's very good. That's right. I forgot to mention it actually. So there's two signs for alpha one could have. One of them violates the dominant energy condition, but leads to causal speed of propagation when you compactify to four dimensions. So that's the good one. Violates dominant energy condition, but things are causal. The other one, in perturbation theory, does not violate dominant energy conditions, but when you compactify to four dimensions, leads to causal speed of propagation. So indeed, this thing has a sign. It's a positive sign in my conventions, which is the nice one that you get in binary string theory, and also the one that doesn't lead to trouble with causality. Very important point. Yes. Thanks.
Like you view these as IR effects? I mean, you had so I'm a bit confused.
That's a good point.
The string stuff, and then you're saying you don't want to compute the string stuff.
That is true. So I'm just saying this is a particular effect that I can capture with a Lorentz effective Lagrangian. I'm not introducing, it's not as seriously a UV thing as putting a spin defect, right?
Well, it depends on what the coefficients are and the alpha compared to R, for example.
That is true. Yeah, very good.
Therefore,
of course.
That's again a UV effect. You're finding in that form.
So it's true that this effect comes from integrating out stuff that comes from the UV. But in the solution that we're going to be looking at, this effect is just going to be important in perturbation theory. Okay, so it's just going to be small.
But then the other classes that you said you didn't want to deal with it, they will also show up as such effects. In other words, even S1, S2, T2, and so on.
But then, for instance, going back to the Witten's case with the periodic boundary conditions, I need to know what is the tension of the spin defect.
You need to know what alpha is too. So I'm just saying you're just reshuffling it in a different form. I don't think they're fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm. I see.
It's not pure IR. If you just it's Einstein's theory, that's it.
I think that's a point well taken. I would just say that, you know, for the spin defect, I need to understand what are the interactions with these guys and so on and so forth. Here is just a one coefficient, but I see that it's just, you know, a matter of.
Other things.
Yeah.
If it was coming from more infrared, it would be more dominant. Less suppressed than the stringy.
Well, the question is, what are the other effects? The main point is not pure Einstein's.
This is true. This is clearly true. Yeah. I get the feeling that I understand this term better because you can just compute it in, you know, string perturbation theory at tree level. It's a very, very controlled thing. Later on, we'll be embedding this model in string theory, and it just comes.
But the other ones, like T2, with periodic boundary conditions, you can go to like reactive poles and all that. So you can also understand them very well too. So it's a string perturbation theory as well. So I don't think that's a good reason.
Mm-hmm. These are the first examples.
Is the argument rely on truncating the expansion?
No, we're not truncating the expansion because the perturbation is always going to be small. So you're going to be able to solve it order by order. In effect, we're just using the first term. That's true, but more terms are going to be suppressed higher order by order in perturbation theory. We don't need like a parametric separation between this term and the others or anything like that. So how do we solve this thing? I told you we're going to be solving this using perturbation theory. And to do perturbation theory, we need to have a background metric. So the background metric that we're going to be taking on this thing. So we need a background metric here. This thing is just a function. We can just see it as a function. So we need a background metric here. The background metric we're going to take is the semi-flat approximation for the metrics. It's basically the Ricci flat metric that one has there. So basically, there's just this metric. Basically, it's just a metric which is good away from the singularities. So there's some function f of c, c bar. I'm basically introducing coordinates on this guy. So there's a complex coordinate z parametrizing the disk, and then there's going to be two coordinates y1, y2 parametrizing the fiber. So the metric is something like this. Form doesn't really matter that much. I just want to illustrate that this is a metric which is Ricci flat. It blows up at the degenerations of the fiber. But it's the metric where you take the fiber to be basically flat. It's the metric of factors. Okay. Just get this particular background metric, and we're going to be solving this. As I said before, you start with this metric, you only get flat solutions like straight domain walls. So what we're going to be doing it the way we're going to be doing it is, so I'm drawing the Z plane that I drew here, like just based on. This thing has a torus vibration on top of it, which is pinching, you know, in some points, actually in 12 points. I'm just going to draw 5 of them. So what we're going to be doing is the following. It turns out that the Gauss-Bonnet perturbation, the source of the, we're going to take this background metric, turn on the background, the Gauss-Bonnet perturbation, and solve order by and solve the first order, the linearized Einstein's equation for the perturbation of the metric. Now it turns out that this Gauss-Bonnet perturbation is very much localized as this course. So actually, you can find a solution if you just you say that the metric of the Borgeson is, as usual, the true metric is the background plus something like this. So it's just like a conformal restraint of the metric. That's all you need to solve the equations in this case. And this perturbation is just, you know, alpha R. That's one. So basically, we're going to be solving it in stages. First of all, we solve this Poisson equation for the metric in the near horizon region of the bubble, where all the pores are localized. So basically, there's some small region, where some region which is small compared to the total size of the Borgeson, but large compared to the size of the cores, where this thing is a small perturbation. We can solve the Poisson equation there. It's just, you know, Poisson's equations. And that gives you a boundary condition for the metric here.
But you're implying that perturbation in alpha. If you will do perturbation in 1 over m, then it goes the other way around.
In 1 over m?
Yeah. Let's say that Planck mass could do infinity. Then you would start from r squared. Look at your direction.
Am I not allowed to always work in Planck units if I want? So everything is 1 and then is small?
Okay, but in this sense, I don't know, it depends what you call perturbation, right?
Yeah. Okay, so the energy scale related to this guy has to be below the Planck scale, yeah. For sure. Much smaller, yes. If that's your point, I completely agree. Yes, that's right. So basically, you solve Einstein's equations here, inside perturbatively, and that gives you some boundary condition here. And the point is that it's not obvious, I guess, from the way I'm explaining it. It's certainly not obvious to me. By solving Einstein's equations like this, with this perturbation gives you the extra source that you need to be able to glue the metric, the perturbative metric that you have here, to the asymptotic, to something with the rest of asymptotics far away. So this perturbation becomes an initial condition for solving the full nonlinear Einstein's equations here. In this region, the Gauss-Bonnet term is small, so we don't care about it anymore. Just solving Einstein's equations numerically here. So in this region, we just solve it numerically. The whole point of this story is that turning on this small perturbation, you know, it's a small perturbation in this core, but by turning on this small perturbation in this core, it's actually enough of a change that we can actually do what we couldn't do before. We can glue with the asymptotic metric. And we need to do that numerically. But for sure, we need to make sure the junction conditions are satisfied.
So just to make sure I understand, the original metric you start with, is it actually singular at those 12 points where the fiber degenerates, or is the curvature finite everywhere there?
So the perturbation. Okay, so
the original metric before you perturb it.
Right. So that metric, the metric that I wrote down here, is singular, but we also have a regularization for that metric close to the singularities. Okay, so this is a metric that we're only taking to be the actual metric slightly away from the cores. Away from the cores is regular. Close to the cores, we know what the exact corrections that we need to put are. So the full metric is regular everywhere.
So it's regular in string theory or as actually...
In GR.
Okay, so you can actually replace that with some Ricci flat metric that would
be...
Taubnut.
It's a Taubnut metric. That's how you regularize this guy. You need to glue the Taubnuts to the semi-flat regime, and then the semi-flat regime, you need to glue to this guy.
Okay. So the only problem originally is the asymptotics were...
That's right. That's the only problem. We were not able to mask the asymptotics. And just the amazing thing is just by turning this perturbation is small here, but it changes the boundary conditions enough that now you can glue it. So what we're doing is actually just perturbatively close to the original metric just in this region. In this other region, it's not anymore.
So if you look at the original string of the singularity flat infinite radius, situation, which means that if you started with a finite radius sphere,
right,
then it would want to become infinite radius. So is it true that this term is bringing an attraction force to balance it?
That's how I understand it.
Balances the
it's giving an extra an extra negative mass contribution so that you can get a zero mass thing which still
the alpha wants to contract the sphere.
That's what I think.
So normally, if you're integrating out stuff, you will get other higher dimensional operators.
Yeah.
Apart from this one. Yeah. So how important is it that you're ignoring all of this?
Well, I'm just solving access equations in this model. So you give just change the hierarchy of the operators, then the whole thing might change. But I'm going to be embedding the model.
How generic is the situation where this is the more important, for example?
This is a proof of concept, okay? I'm just saying that that there's no topological obstruction, and this dynamical obstruction you basically get rid because the dominant energy condition just doesn't hold generically. And I'm just showing you a very simple model where I just do those two things at the same time, and bam, there's a bubble. Also, this model, I'm just going to show you that this particular model with these higher derivative terms embeds in string theory. So that's, one good thing for the model. But this is far from constructing these things in general, of course, for sure. There might also be maybe you have a non-supersymmetric situation where for some reason dominant energy condition is satisfied, and then this also wouldn't work, okay? So basically, you solve for these things, and we actually have the action for the bubble. So it's a number, it's an actual number that you need to compute numerically. The volume of the asymptotic T3, alpha square, and g newton. So you start in d dimensions, then in d minus 3 dimensions. Okay, so the g newton of the lower dimensional theory. So first thing you see is that when alpha sends when alpha goes to zero, we go to the next limit, the instanton disappears, which is what you should have. So there we go. Okay, so that is the model. That is the bubble. There's a bubble. Questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have estimates for alpha in say string rectifications with energy small Cindy breaking? And in particular, can you estimate whether or not this is fast? This is a faster decay than known decay channel such that
brain. So the honest answer, no, I don't have estimates, but I would guess generally bubbles of nothing are more surprised than, for instance, brain bubble nucleation. That's always the case.
We do have estimates for these kind of terms at 4D, right? So this is like KHC2 in the Calabia alpha. This is a coefficient of either chi plus sigma or chi minus sigma kind of thing. This R squared.
Chi plus sigma?
It's a combination of chi and sigma, right? Or the characteristic and signature.
So the model that I have in mind, you actually get this from string perturbation theory in 10 dimensions, the string scale.
So K wedge C2, so area wedge C2. So if you take a Calabi-Yau threefold, like type 2 string, there's
right,
a one loop correction, the string theory, which allows you to compute that term alpha, which is known what is topological, and it is a Kähler class wedge with the second Chern class of Calabi-Yau. So it's well known in string units. I'm talking about string units. It's computable, so
right.
You could check
right. So in the type 1 model that we are going to be embedding this, this is actually it's just there you go. Right. So what is the type 1? I'm just going to use this line. Let me try it again. So I'm just gonna embed this. I'm just going to be embedding this in type 1 string theory. So we're going to be considering type 1 on T3. Okay? So we're first going to be doing this. This is going to be a supersymmetric thing. This is still supersymmetric. But then we're going to compactify in a second T3. And something's going to happen to this T3 so that we have the bubble. And we'll see how this comes about. I think it's a very nice resolution. So if I want to embed the type 1 Lagrangian, so basically the reason why I want to do it like this is because then I can just take the 10D Lagrangian and reduce on T3. So what the 10D Lagrangian has is these terms plus the usual Nevius Schwarz. This you can compute from string perturbation theory. You also get the the nearest first terms plus the, you know, the gauge fields. Okay, so to embed the bubble, we're going to set the gauge fields to zero. And, well, it naively seems that we could also set H to zero, naively. So if we set H to zero, then the action that we have is the same. We can just embed the bubble straight away, right? So this is an action. You should think of this as an action in seven dimensions. I compactorize the seven dimensions. And then I have this the second T3. So in the second T3, I could embed the bubble in this way. However, there is one ingredient, one crucial ingredient that I'm missing, which is the type 1 as a Bianchi identity. So you cannot set H to 0, because dH is equal, let me get the coefficient straight, yeah. There's an R squared. Okay? Now, the question is, does our Bordism turn on this trace of R squared? The answer is yes. Has a non-trivial index, it's a four-dimensional manifold that turns this thing on. So we're going to have some H. So if you just draw the Bordism like this, you get the T3. And then, you know, this thing appears the Bordism. By using Stokes' theorem, what you learn is that on the asymptotic T3, there's going to be these many units of H flux.
These are
the
NS5 brains, right?
There are no NS5 brains in this configuration. This is all smooth. So these things, the singular limit of these things is, of course, NS5 brains. But we're looking at the smooth geometry. They have the same charge as NS5 brains, but they are not NS5 brains. Okay? So this turns on some H field. So we have a T3, which is threaded by 12 units of H flux. So that's why we get a bubble. We turn on our flux that breaks supersymmetry. So everything is fine and well. We didn't do anything wrong. So you basically get this this picture. The bubble solution still holds because the energy density associated to these guys is subleading the alpha prime expansion. So the bubble still embeds.
Sorry, there's something funny here.
Yeah.
T3 shrinks to nothing, right?
T3 shrinks to nothing.
So there's something in contradiction with dH not having a delta function source somewhere.
No, but the sources for H are these guys. It's the geometry itself.
So you're setting H on
T3? H on T3, it's the integral. Oh, sorry, yeah, the P of H on T3 is just the integral of this thing on the Bordism.
But dH is
dH is equal to this thing. I'm just using Stokes' theorem here.
Okay.
This could be NS5 brains. It's just like I've desingularized them and they have become geometry. Okay.
That makes me more worried about your philosophy, that you were trying to avoid exactly things like an S5 brains and things that are
but here's the thing. So what I wanted to avoid is things that are singular from the point of view of an effective field theory. And in heterodic on type 1, what happens is that there are certain large solitons that I can understand from the effective field theory which have the same charges as some brains. That's what's going on here. This trace of R squared is huge. It's huge. It's something that I can perfectly well. It's like a huge instanton in Yamil's theory. It has the same charges, but it's fine.
Why don't you turn on F instead of H?
Very good. So you could try and turn on F. This seems simpler. You could try to do something like standard embedding. You try to turn F and H. That shouldn't work because that is also supersymmetric. So that shouldn't work. Because you will be basically turning no H flux in infinity, so it will be a bubble of nothing for something supersymmetric. What happens is when you do that, effectively, this term in the Lagrangian, we look into this. This term effectively becomes proportional to this term with the opposite sign. So the embedding doesn't work. Bubble does not exist in that case.
If I understand correctly, that you're considering type 1 on T6, and you put some units of H fluxes on one of the torus?
Yes, on one of the T3s.
Isn't that already perturbatively unstable?
Yes, very good. So, of course, this is going to blow up. This is something, you know, by making the flux very dilute and so on and so forth, you're going to be able to make it very slow. But this is actually this. Yeah, of course, it's perturbative. Yeah, so this is going to be it's similar to the situation that you had with Witten's radial bout of nothing. You have the circle, you got to stabilize the circle somehow, and we were not very specific about how that was happening. So here it's more or less the same.
Well, I think, but I criticize your approach versus Ed's. Witten did not have the perspective of what we have today on string theory.
That's true.
We know this is not possible. For him, he said, let's discuss it on my hand.
That's right. So it's true. In these verses,
that should bother us.
Yes. So the only thing that I wanted to the main point of us trying to embed this particular bubble in this particular modern string theory was to show that the particular effects that violate the dominant energy condition that we're getting actually show up in string theory. I agree. This is not completely satisfactory because the torus, you know, it has a runaway. But if you were able to stabilize it in some way. Maybe a bubble of like this could still exist. I agree. In any case, it's a perturbative instability which is going to be leading.
Does your bubble solution have zero mass?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Bubble has to have
the mass.
Yes. Actually, so because we computed all erases, but we computed the full action of the Euclidean solution, so that means that we have computed the. So is the full Euclidean solution automatically has zero alien mass? If you solve Euclidean solution, Parsons equations. So.
Yeah. I'm probably wrong, and then I'm sorry, but isn't this related to M theory on K3?
Related to M theory on K3?
I should know this thing, correct?
Oh, maybe I should know this. So.
No, I thought.
No, but maybe I don't know what point you want to make.
Well, whether you have an M theory feature of the same thing.
I don't know, I haven't thought about it. Possibly yes, because you can dualize and whatever. But why are you asking specifically about the M theory picture?
Because K3 appeared before, but it's probably totally unrelated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anyway. So basically, just to belabor the point a little bit, you can visualize here on the two cycles of the three torus, and you basically can see that this is type to be oriented for.
To lift my confusion,
The
lift to 10D, does it now work or not? Because of this Bianchi identity thing.
Because of this what, sorry?
The Bianchi identity.
It works.
We try,
exactly. We need to turn on this H units of flux.
Then it works.
So as Jagger was pointing out, that makes it work, so the bubble is still embedded. So you have this H3 solution, which has a bubble of nothing configuration. So there's a point that we made also there. You might worry that the instanton does not really embed, because instantons are about, you know, bounces are about solutions of the classical equations of motion, right? Like when you do a bounce, you go from a false vacuum to a different vacuum. Here we don't have a vacuum because there's a runaway. But the zero mass solution that we can construct is actually a family of negative mass solutions. So the negative mass solutions, they still embed. So at least we have exhibited a family of negative mass solutions in this place. Okay, so as I was saying, you can visualize to an oriented model, or type 2B, and then the flux that we turn on here becomes 2,1 plus 1,2. So it's imaginary, so it's very imaginary, so dual fluxes of the kind that, for instance, you know, you would get from the Gino and KKLP. So basically, we have a bubble that can eat flux, and it's there. Okay, so this is what I can tell you about the particular example that we have. It has some drawbacks, particularly the runaway. But other than that, the surprising thing is that there's no topological protection and no dynamical protection for these kind of things. So
I'm sorry for interrupting. I'm really surprised by this. So let me just make sure I understand the picture. You're taking a 10-dimensional supersymmetric theory.
Yes.
You're finding a solution which is of the form, well, asymptotically, it's four-dimensional Minkowski space cross something,
mm-hmm.
and it is a supersymmetric boundary condition you're putting
on
at infinity.
But the supersymmetry is being broken by the flux.
So at infinity, the supersymmetry is broken.
That's right. Yes. So this is nice. When I try to embed this solution in string theory, automatically the Bianchi identity tells me that I need to turn on the flux. So turning on the flux is the thing that breaks supersymmetry. Of course, there's obviously no way that we're going to be able to find anything like this from supersymmetric vacuum.
And it's not even asymptotically Minkowski, right? Because
it is not even asymptotically Minkowski. That's right. It's a quintessence thing. Yeah, has positive vacuum energy. That's right. In the expansion that we're having, we're neglecting that. We just, the coverage is very small. But yeah.
But there's also a dominal vacuum, right? If you look
that is very good. Yeah, that's true indeed. Because we have the H flux in this particular example, you can also just have, you know, like a bunch of NS5 brains actually eating up the flux as well. And that probably is going to be the leading decay channel, because whenever you have fundamental brains, it's really...
Can't you think of this as a composition of an NS5 brain bubble with a bubble of nothing? Couldn't the bubble of nothing then just separate off and recollapse, and you just...
Well, topologically, at least you can do that. Yeah, you could just take the trace of R squares of the geometry and turn it into, you know, an NS5 brain. So one thing that perhaps is related to this in string theory, but not in geometry, is just to take Witten's bubble of nothing and then try to fix the flux and the spin of the boundary condition just by putting in NS5 brains. Maybe that's a singular limit of this thing.
So I'm wondering, if the bubble expands, couldn't it be that from the bubble that's expanding, it splits into two. One is the bubble of nothing, and the other one is the NS5 brains expanding. The material bubble recollapses.
Certainly not in the perturbative description that we have.
Still a bubble of nothing. Even if it's stressed by the brain?
Yes.
You're going to be a hot vacuum decay to a true vacuum.
Well, okay.
Okay, no, yeah, maybe we can. I just wanna make the more general points. Analysis, general remarks. How can we extend this? How general is this picture? Where can we hope to find more things like this? Well, the four-dimensional speed Bayesian group is Z and is generated by K3. So K3 is topologically protected like no one. But omega-5, omega-6, and omega-7, they all vanish. So you would expect that constructions like this can be done for second Einstein guys, Calabi Gauss, manifolds of G2 alone. So, you know, the idea is that whenever you break supersymmetry in any small way, it might very well be the case that it also comes with perturbative instabilities, and then we're done, for sure. But at the very least, there's this universal instability that you can understand from the point of view of purely low energy effective theory that is always there. And I find that pretty interesting.
So these are related in the supersymmetric case to Calabi at 3/4, G2 has been set.
That's right. Yeah, so then I'm just going to be very, very quick and mention that there's an extension of all of this to fluxes. So when you have fluxes, you need to compute, you know, spin partition groups with, they're denoted like this. There's this thing called the classifying space, and basically the point is that you can compute them, and in these cases, so maybe a question that you might have after hearing this is, okay, is my favorite compactification, can I do this with my favorite compactification with fluxes and whatever? So I'm just going to tell you that whenever you have fluxes, there's these things that you can look in the math literature to figure out if your thing is trivial or not, and whenever you have fluxes, there are numbers one can compute which are Bordism invariants. So for instance, if you have a 6-manifold and a U1 bundle, which has a churn class C, or, you know, field strength, F cubed is a Bordism invariant. So as long as this thing holds exactly your theory, for a U1 bundle this holds, but I'm being careful here. So these things are Bordism invariants. So if your manifold has a non-vanishing number like this, then you're not going to be able to find a vacuum. So examples of flux compactifications like this, for instance, your favorite ADS5 cross S5 has a non-trivial Bordism invariant, which is just the integral of F5. So this guy, you're not going to be able to construct an energy Bordism that is going to a topological obstruction. But what if we look at, you know, ADS5 times CP3 in theory? Well, then there's no obstruction that we can write down because you only have G-form flux, and there's no way to integrate G-form flux in a 6-manifold, so I have to give you something. And we would conclude that there's no topological obstruction for having a bubble of nothing. And indeed, for this model, a bubble of nothing was constructed by Spodienko and agree.
And so if I replace S5 with a non-supersymmetric Einstein manifold?
It would still, for this case, there's not much you can do about it, because you can always integrate this on any 5 manifold. Unless you make it very weird, like non-orientable or something.
But you still expect an instability.
Yeah, you should still expect an instability.
It could be different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it could be different. I will just mention, just you take it for whatever it's worth. There's been a lot of discussion in here about this massive pathway vacuum, right? Which, in a minimal model, you can construct by turning on F0, F4, and H3 fluxes as a compactification to four dimensions. There's also no Bordism invariants here. The vacuum is supersymmetric, but you might also suspect that there's something not working quite right with the construction. And if that is the case, perhaps you could still have some sort of bubble of nothing in a vacuum like this. So the initial argument you don't have bubbles of nothing is the positive energy theorem. It's about having a unitary supersymmetric theory. Perhaps what happens in these kind of examples is you get a non-unitary but supersymmetric theory. I'm just saying that there's no topological obstruction for this guy to decay, and perhaps there's something there. So that's the take-home message. Nothing really matters, so let's just go have lunch.
So maybe you wrote this before and I missed it, but can you write down the nucleation rate of these bubbles of nothing?
Yeah.
Like in this example, for instance, how it depends on alpha prime?
I did, but when I was quick. It's like this. So it goes like a number, volume of asymptotic torus, g Newton in d minus 3 dimensions, and alpha squared. Alpha prime. That's right.
Okay, and my second question is, so do these, you're saying like this thing breaks supersymmetry because of the flux?
Yeah.
But isn't this unstable to, annihilating the flux with some, if you have some breaks around? But crucially, then the true vacuum is supersymmetric, right?
That's right. So this thing is unstable in a number of ways. So first of all, there's a perturbative instability, as Jacob was saying.
But there's also this flux.
There's so-called this flux, these like basically NS5 brains that eat up the flux. That's more like a, this is more like a Coleman de Lucia kind of thing.
Right.
And then the vacuum, the endpoint of the vacuum for that is supersymmetric. That is a valid decay channel for this guy. I'm saying that this guy also has this other decay channel.
Sure, what is the decay rate?
So I haven't computed it, but it's very likely going to be less suppressed than this one.
So you're going to be faster.
It's going to be faster.
So you're going to decay into the Susi breaking vacuum faster than you're going to nucleate these bubbles.
Statistically, yes. The only point...
Therefore, you cannot make these bubbles.
Well, I mean, no, it's a statistical thing. There's a chance that you could, right? You got to be lucky or unlucky, depending on your point of view, I guess. The point for us is that there's a universal instability. There's a universal kind of instability that you can find in any bubble. It's often not the leading instability. This can be perturbative. It can be... some other. Whenever you have a Coleman de Lucia kind of thing, it's always typically less suppressed.
It would be nice to have an example
in which this is the leading instability. I completely agree.
Yes. What if you would apply the similar reason to a GKP vacuum with Susi breaking three-form fluxes? Because you see, you might conclude from your analysis there is an instability, but GKLT is correct. They get quantum corrected to supersymmetric ADS vector, and they should not be unstable.
Yeah, that's a good point. This is just the topological obstruction. This is just telling you there might not be a bubble. As we've seen, that's not enough. You need to have the dynamics. So in case that KKLT is right, then in the supersymmetric vacuum, you're going to be obeying the domain energy condition. Maybe you're obeying the domain energy condition also before quantum effects. So there could also be examples where, for some random reason, you obey the domain energy condition, and this thing doesn't decay.
But it's really interesting to study that case because, the 0.3 flux, it will not be enough, but the 1.2 that is induced locally by the neocondensate, it might be the source of having this bubble.
It doesn't break Susi, this flux.
1.2? That's precisely the point. One has to study the dynamics, so I don't know the answer. But if you study the dynamics, and you're violating the corresponding energy theorem, and you could have the bubble, the fact that you could have a bubble in a supersymmetric vacuum, what tells you that supersymmetric vacuum is inconsistent. There is something wrong with it. So it would be a way also to try to to distinguish what strange fire supersymmetric vacuum are actually consistent.
If you find a bubble of nothing in something that shouldn't have it, then something is wrong.
But I have to study the dynamics. I mean.
But But you will get in the usual problem that you need to solve a classical system because you always have to analyze Einstein equations, but then you need to know how to do that from 10 years.
Yeah, but the point, the take-home message of this thing is you get how the terms can be important. So it could go either way, I guess. It would be pretty interesting. So the point is that, you know, supersymmetry by itself is not protecting you from having balls of nothing. It's supersymmetry plus unitarity. Okay? The proof in a supersymmetric theory, the mass is positive. It uses the positive definiteness of the inner product. So if the way that some of these vacua, if it was possible that some of these vacua, the way they're wrong is because they don't have a secretly they become non-invariant. It might be that the Lorentz effect reaction you could embed these things. It's just a dream. Or, well, you know, yeah, dreams not there. This is recorded. So. It's just like, you know, it's a possibility you might think of.
ADS, the Gauss-Bonnet time, can have negative.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, so I haven't thought about that, but that's right. In ADS, it can go either way, and we actually have concrete examples where it goes either way. So this causality analysis is very much Minkowskian.
So, one question I have is that we know we live in a non-supersymmetric background. We don't know if it's stable or not. Let's assume it were stable. Then we know there is a bubble of nothing, if the cohortism statement is correct.
Right.
Do we have any ideas of how to estimate that?
The nucleation rate.
Whatever else we are given. We compared it to potential models for the de Sitter's decay.
So I don't know how, without knowing, like, even to construct this bubble, I need to know that some details about the compactification. Like, just from pure IR, just from the point of view of, you know, the lower dimensional theory, the de Sitter, I don't see a way. You know, this nucleation rate depends on the size of the internal dimensions and things like this.
It would be great, like, that's really a dream for me. It would be great if one could have a more general understanding of this and connect this decay rate to the breaking of supersymmetry. And then, yeah, it applies more
generally. Any other questions? No, that's my thing.